Morning, everybody. Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. Thanks for staying up later with us. Ed Derrick is on the phone. The book is The Final Mission of Extortion 1-7, Special Ops, Helicopter Support, SEAL Team 6, and the Deadliest Day of the U.S. War in Afghanistan. Hey, Ed, thanks very much for staying up a little late with us tonight. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I've been reading the book. I didn't get through all of it. I will go back and read this after we're done because it's a fascinating read. And I know you take great care to get into details about the members who suffered through this day. And what I've really been reading about so far is just the incredible complexity of these missions. And that's something that I think we take for granted. I mean, I would guess, Ed, for most of us, we've seen maybe Black Hawk Down or we've seen Zero Dark 30. And that's kind of our knowledge of what goes on as far as helicopter flying and missions in the current theater of war that we are with the war on terror. But you're writing about things in here about the complexities, not only of the helicopters and the missions, but how they work and how they work within the structure of command within our armed forces. Talk to me just a little bit to set it up about how these operations generally run and how maybe it's different than in previous wars that from, say, way back when with Vietnam, because we use these special operational forces so often now to really get I don't want to say the dirty work, but a lot of the most important work, you know, going in and taking out leaders of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whoever it is, it seems like we rely very heavily on those special forces to take out the leaders of a lot of these groups now. Is that fairly accurate?
Yeah, exactly. It's very well stated. The difference from decades past is that there are many more facets to the overall operation, and each facet is much more highly refined just through time. There's a lot of technical intelligence gathering capabilities. There's just so much more to it. There's a lot of training. There's a lot of interoperability between the services or among the services. And one of the important facts that people don't really realize is that conventional forces work much more hand in hand in modern times than with special operations forces. And previously, they used to be somewhat insular. They work together very much hand in hand these days, as I explained in the book.
And it didn't exactly start out that way, though, right? I mean, one of the people you were quoting in here had talked about when he had come back to Afghanistan on a later tour that it was working better, that for a while there were some problems with the special forces were coming in and doing things while the regular forces were trying to build coalitions within towns and things like that. And sometimes the two wouldn't jive together very well.
Exactly. That's exactly how it went. And now it's much more smooth. I think a good way to look at it is back in the back in the World War II, where you had a very parochial setup because you had the army running, not only the army itself at commanding, and the Navy running itself at commanding, and so then you get people vying for who's going to take charge in this theater. Whereas after the Goldwater-Nichols Department of Defense Reorganization Act of 1986, not to get too technical, but it took the service chiefs and they just were in charge of training and equipping and organizing their services. And then you had these individual entities like CENTCOM, SOUTHCOM, and they were headed by chiefs of those specific geographic areas, and they ran the war. So things are much more fluidly integrated these days. So there's much less infighting. And now with Special Operations Forces, which U.S. Special Operations Command, and then conventional forces, that there was some friction, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, mid-2000s. But by now, just like the different services were working together more smoothly, now those two service types are working together more smoothly. And it just continues to get better every day.
Well, and I imagine another issue here is that, you know, you mentioned, like, say, in World War II, here's how it worked, but this war on terror is really a war on ideology. And while maybe World War II was also a war on ideology, we knew where the Germans were, and there were huge groups of them, and
yeah,
we could plan out an attack. And now, with the war on terror, it's so, you know, who are they? Where are they? It's not groups of thousands of troops together. It's little pockets. And that's, I imagine, why you need the special forces. And I imagine for the regular forces, for the army and the people that are on the ground there all the time, it's got to be so different because they're not there necessarily fighting an enemy. They're trying to build and give the opportunity for democracy to start flourishing in a place where that has been oppressed. It must be just very different. I imagine a lot of these generals that have been around a long time are relearning everything that they once knew about how they wanted to fight wars.
Well, I don't know about the generals relearning stuff, but you're exactly right in terms of the evolution of the way we fight wars, where it goes against a specific nation to where it's an ideology, where it's a nation, everybody's geographically in the same area with an ideology. It's just, you know, can be anywhere. And that's why intelligence gathering is so important and vetting of intelligence and processing of intelligence. And I get into that in the book as well. And it's just, like I said before, it's just so refined. You have to be able to first identify who is the enemy, where are they? And then that's when you can go after them. But you can't just go to, you know, to a country and say everybody here is the enemy. That's not the case, just like you said.
Let's talk a little bit about Extortion 1-6 and Extortion 1-7, these groups that go in and do exfills and infills that get people in, get people out, or go after targets. The main story of the book, what happened on August 6, 2011, is the tragedy that happened with Extortion 1-7. But you tell other stories about you know, this is their job. This is what they do all the time. And it's harrowing because mostly these flights are at night, right? Because they've got to go in under cover of darkness. And that alone, I think we take for granted how difficult that truly is for the pilots and the forces that then hit the ground.
Yeah, I just like to say for all the people listening, I say this book is a story of stories. It's all bound together by the one incident that's a tragedy. You know, it's a story of the individual pilots, the crew, the helicopter, what this operation was, how it was going on that night and then early morning. And also, like you explained, the difficulty in flying these missions because they're flying on night vision goggles, which you only have a 40-degree field of view, where during the day with your bare eyes, you've got 180 degrees, and you're seeing in shades of green. And you're flying, you know, these missions that you have to be on the ground within a window of just seconds. And the crew and the pilots have to operate fluidly and operate fluidly with the passengers. It's an incredible orchestration. And in incredibly dangerous areas. It's really phenomenal what these people go through. And it was, you know, to do these jobs. And I really got into all that in the book, as you know, like you said.
Yeah, it's incredibly detailed and tells the story, the human side of these guys too, and women, because we don't think about that a lot. And, you know, I guess we do when we hear the tragedies that happen. But you know, I just feel like also in the last couple of years, the war on terror rages on and we've become so numb to it. We don't hear about it as much. We don't think about it as much unless there's a big terrorist attack. And this is the work that's still going on every day in places across the Middle East and Afghanistan and Pakistan and other places.
Every day and we'll never hear about it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's secret.
So is this the type of mission that if it hadn't gone wrong, we would never even know about? Is this just one of so many different missions that they're doing all the time that are basically top secret for a certain amount of years, and we'll hear about them down the road when stories are told many years from now?
Yeah, if that, I mean, a lot of stuff's classified for 25 years, I believe. And if it, you know, these raids happen all the time, and they happened all the time during Operation Enduring Freedom. And just like you said, we know about it because of the tragedy. And so that's, if you can say there's a good thing about this tragedy, that's it, because it brings it to light and it brings the people who perform these jobs to light and the types of missions and what they were doing. And that's, I think that's important for the American public to know, because people just don't really get how, you know, less than 1% of the population is in the military. And I've never been in the military. I've been very fortunate to have been embedded in with Marines primarily, but other services in Afghanistan 4 times and Iraq twice. So I could see it up close, but it's so much more complex and so much more dangerous than I think a lot of people realize. And these stories of tragedy, like I said, if you could, you know, say a good thing about it, is that it provides a window of opportunity for understanding for the general public.
Yeah. I don't want to get political at all with this question, but I do wonder, because here in the U.S., those of us that aren't in the military, we have the great luxury of being able to debate what we should and shouldn't be doing in all these theaters. But there, yeah. they're getting orders and they're following them, and they're incredible yeah. about it. Do from all the forces that you've met over the years, do they talk much about whether they're happy or not? Because it's got to be frustrating that they're running these missions all the time. They're doing these things all the time. They're trying to cut the head off the snake, and that person's always replaced. And it seems like, I wonder if to them they feel like they're getting somewhere because they get through this, or they feel like now there's another person they have to go. And eventually bad things happen. You know, we have tragedies because that's just the nature of what's happening. What's the morale of the forces that you meet with and interview over the years?
Tremendously high. Everybody I've always met and been with in the field and back home talking about is very high. And they do feel that they're making progress. It's hard to gauge progress because it's hard to know what disasters like 9/11 have been prevented had we done nothing.
Yeah.
And I think that these terrorist networks are look at ISIS. I mean, you don't see too many ISIS beheading videos anymore. They're on the run. They're getting destroyed big time. You just don't hear about it. There's no embedded media. There's no news on it,
yeah.
but they're getting wiped out. They're wiped out big time. Al-Qaeda, Taliban. There's a lot of it too that is behind the scenes with the military working with the State Department, because a lot of these entities like the Taliban, they are supported by not countries but entities within countries like Pakistan. So there's a lot of, you know, also the money supplies. So there's a lot going on that we just don't know about, and there's a lot of, just like we don't know about these missions that, like you said, unless there's a tragedy. We just don't know about all the successes, and there's lots of them. There's a lot of them. So
I imagine there's tons of successes every single day. And
yeah, there is. It's just we don't see it like, yeah. you know, like Victory at Sea back in World War II with like these giant battles with these sinking battleships. You just don't get that anymore. So
yeah, this war is won by a million little victories instead of a few big victories, I guess, right?
That is extremely well said. That is so well said. Absolutely. Absolutely. And with that, and that's the thing, we don't really know because they're so small, little victories. We just don't know about them, but we don't see these, you know, spectacular 9/11 events. You know, we just saw those just one time. So,
Ed Derrick is with us. The book is The Final Mission of Extortion 1-7. I have to take a quick break and we have to do the news. Can you hang on just a little bit more? Because I'd love to get in a little bit more about how these operations work and have you tell a little bit of the story of what happened that night to Extortion 1-7. Can you hang on for a couple minutes, Ed?
Of course. Thank Excellent. You very much. Sure.
Ed Derrick is with us. The book, again, The Final Mission of Extortion 1-7, Special Ops Helicopter Support SEAL Team 6, and the Deadliest Day of the U.S. War in Afghanistan. This happened not long after they got Osama bin Laden, and members of the SEAL Team 6 that were there that night were there this night, and we'll get into that more after we check the news upstairs. There's Roger Battish. Dave, Brian, Pat, Alex, and Spencer learned of their mission for the August 5th, 6th period of darkness in the early evening of August 5th, 2011. Along with pilot CW-4 Rick Arnold and CW-2 Jeremy Collins, door gunner Sergeant John Brooks and FE Sergeant John Itwali and Staff Sergeant Brandon Robinson, they would launch a two-ship mission carrying a strike force of Team Darby Rangers into the heart of the Tangi Valley. After a series of briefings, including one with Nighthawk planners, the strike force, consisting of four squads of Team Darby Rangers, a JTAC from the 24th Special Tactics Squadron, a cultural support team member, and a military working dog, 48 passengers total, loaded into the two Chinooks, mission call signs Extortion 1-6 and Extortion 1-7. What happens next that night? We'll talk about it after the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Matt Bubala with you here, 720 WGN. Thank you for the news, Roger Battish. Ed Derrick is on the phone with us. We continue our conversation about his book, The Final Mission of Extortion 1-7. Ed, as I was going into the news there, I was reading just a little section of how they found out about the mission that day, who would be going on it, things like that. Is that how it generally works? I imagine there's not a, you know, so I apologize that my basis of knowledge here is from movies, but so in, say, Zero Dark Thirty, they plan for months it sounds like, what's going to happen when they try to go get Osama bin Laden. And they have, you know, little models out, and they I think I read that they practiced the whole thing before they did it at least once. But it sounds like every day there's new missions, and they find out that morning and they go on them that night. And there's not a lot of time for a lot of in-depth planning. And it also sounds like that the forces that come together, not all of them work together all the time. So, you know, there's certain – it sounds like the crew is a little bit mixed. And depending on the operation and what's going to happen, there might be people there that you don't work with every day, that you don't get boots on the ground with every single day. Is that true?
Yes and no. In general, a lot of these special operations forces – work together frequently, and now the units work together all the time, and maybe there'll be new people cycling in and cycling out, but the majority of the people have worked together a lot, and to include the helicopter pilots and crew who are supporting them, some of the members of Extortion 17, particularly Dave Carter, they were actually he was actually specifically requested by the SEALs. They knew about him from when he was supporting them in Iraq for special operations over there. But you're exactly right. These, you know, an operation like the Abbottabad Pakistan raid on the bin Laden compound, you know, that was a special, you know, special situation where they really applied an awful lot of resources to that for obvious reasons. But in general, for the, you know, there's no run of the mill operation, but for a lot of these operations, or most all of them, they're intel triggered operations where they've been watching these people for months and months, and sometimes even over a year. They maintain eyes on these individuals, and once they act, they get what's called an intel hit, an intel trigger, and then they can formulate an operation based on their previous experiences and then go for it.
And
so that's how this happened.
Well, and so when they go on a mission like this, you know, we always think of, okay, they put a bunch of SEALs in a helicopter, go drop them off, they go get the bad guy, they come back and go. But it's so much more complicated than that. It's not just the two helicopters that are in the air. Tell us a little bit about all of the layers of data that they're trying to glean, not just from these two helicopters that are bringing the people in. Who else is in the air at the time when, like, this mission is going on?
You have two AH-64 Apache gunships. The gunships and the pilots, also Army Aviation, also co-located at Forward Operating Base Schenck with the Extortion Company and the Chinooks and the SEALs and the Army Rangers. They played an incredibly critical role in all these operations. And then there's an AC-130 gunship overhead. Oftentimes there's a Predator UAV, you know, more commonly called a drone. There are signals intelligence gathering aircraft like RC-12 Guardrail or MC-12 Liberty, which nobody's heard of. They're very secretive. Even people in the military know little about them or nothing about them. And they're there to gather intel constantly, real time. And then there's a satellite that's parked up above them, and there's processing centers. And there's a U-28 aircraft that's in the air. It's just like you said, there's a stack of aviation assets, and they're all working hand in hand and integrated in tightly into this complex orchestration.
So these two Chinooks are carrying all these guys out there at the start of the mission. And then there might be 3,000 feet in the air or 7,000 feet in the air, another aircraft, and then thousands more feet in the air. Another. I mean, there might have been four or five aircraft all sort of concentrated on this one mission, right?
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Yep.
We would never think of that, I think. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's the thing. You just don't. A lot of times people just think about the helicopter carrying the SEALs, and it lands and they do their thing. But there's all these other aviation assets up there. So, by the way, you're really good. I mean, you really did read this. I really appreciate that. You pronounce everything right. I'm very happy. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I'm taking a guess on a lot of the things I'm saying as far as the pronunciation. So I'm glad it's working.
But you got exactly right. No, it's very impressive. I appreciate it. There's a lot of stuff in this book. You know, I really get into this stuff a lot.
Yeah.
And sometimes I stray a little bit farther away from like the general reading, you know, kind of maybe, you know, get a little bit closer to writing for the practitioner. I don't mean to do that. It's a book for everybody, and the editors make it that way. But there's a lot of stuff in this book.
Well, so I think it's good that you get more heavily into the detail than just keeping it dumbed down for us, because if you want it, it's there. If you don't, you might glaze your eyes over a little bit at some of this because it does get into the details, but it helps to understand that it's harder to understand and much more complicated than you would ever guess. I mean, I would have never, you know, I know that they've got night vision, their satellites taking photos, and we've seen stuff like that, but I would never guess that the level of complexity with these, and still everything can go wrong, right? I mean, they get all this intelligence and their whole, you know, they do the best they can to have the intelligence to go after in this situation. Is it Lefty Grove? Is that the name?
Objective Lefty Grove, Tari Kahir. That was, you know, the intel people, they assign these names to the objectives, and who knows why they can use any convention they want.
Yeah.
They just use different names. So that's who they're going after. Yep.
So Lefty Grove, they're going after. And basically, they had taken somebody else out months before. This guy filled the power void, and he was taking over. Now they wanted to try to take him out. Based on intelligence, he was going to be having a meeting at this place. And so here's the setup. We're going to go in and try and take him out. The helicopters land, of course, a couple miles away, because he can't just, even a quiet Chinook helicopter can't just land on top of a place without making plenty of noise and warning. So they land. Yep. Everybody pours out of the helicopters and starts heading on foot. In pitch black on kind of a moonless night with just their infrared goggles that they put on to see where they're going, the Chinooks take back off, head back to base, and wait further instruction. And so what happened was he wasn't there, right? Lefty was gone?
Well, he was there, but he got away. He got away, and so that's why Extortion 17 went back out, filled with SEALs, to do what's called a blocking position in the Western Valley. And that's when, like you said before, regardless of all the technology and the skill and the preparation, a lucky shot took the helicopter out while it was coming into land. You know, you can never get rid of luck. You can never get rid of the enemy's luck. Luck still has a say. But he was there. He was just moving. He got away. So.
And so basically, you know, they see all this, the helicopters see, and the great thing is, I don't know if it's a great thing, but fascinating to me also is that these helicopters have three, is it right? The Chinooks that drop them off also have three guys on guns in the helicopter itself, right? So as they're dropping people off, as they're coming in, they see people, if they see things through their goggles, they can also engage or just try to protect the helicopter. But so Extortion 17 has to come back in. They're bringing more people in, to, as you said, because they scattered, because they've got to chase these people down now. And it's interesting because the way the mission started, Extortion 16 and 17 are dropping everybody off. But when they come back with a whole load of people, the now the area they have to land is so small they can only send one ship in, because and they want to avoid, specifically because of something like this, the feeling was you bring in the second ship afterwards, then you've created such a long period of time, I guess, with ships coming into the same area that the enemy can set up, can get a shot off.
Exactly. And they did that they put everybody on board for a number of reasons. There was a lot more people in the initial raid that was two Chinooks. In this immediate reaction force is what it was called, was they had, I think it was a force total of 25, to include 8 Afghans. And so Jonas Kelsall, one of the SEAL Team 6 members, the commander actually of that force, wanted all the troops on the ground at the same time. So they wanted everybody on one helicopter, and you never want to go to the same landing zone twice. Like, they didn't want to fly into the other landing zone that they had initially flown into, because they wanted to, you know, have the element of surprise, and they came in from a totally different direction. And so they did everything as they should have done it. And they, you know, they just never got on the ground. So
is it just
a lucky shot, just less than a minute before landing?
And is it just, is part of it that it I imagine the danger becomes exponential once you've already dropped troops off, once there's been engagement, because there had been shots fired, there had been engagement. So now everybody on the ground in that area is aware, and the enemy is maybe just waiting to hear the sounds of another helicopter and just take shots, right?
Yeah, we'll never know the mindset or what those guys who shot at the helicopter, and which one of the shots actually hit the rotor blade and caused it to crash and kill everybody. We'll never know what was going through their minds. I mean, presumably they could have heard an operation going on farther down the valley, but there's no way they could have known that Extortion 1-7 would be coming, when it came, where it came, and who it would be carrying. They just heard a helicopter coming, grabbed RPGs, and shot at it and got a lucky shot. So,
how many of the – there were members of SEAL Team 6 on that helicopter who had been on the Osama bin Laden raid?
No. The unit is called Naval Special Warfare Development Group, and it's popularly called SEAL Team 6. And it's broken into a number of different squadrons. Okay. The squadron that performed the bin Laden raid was Red Squadron. This squadron was called Gold Squadron, TACDEVRON 3, Tactical Development and Evaluation Squadron 3. So, yeah.
Were there any changes made in the way that the forces come into battle like this in the wake of Extortion 1-7 and what happened? Are there lessons they learned, or sometimes do they write things off as... sometimes the enemy, you know, will get their shots in and there's nothing we can do about that?
Unfortunately, that's the case. I mean, the enemy shot at helicopters in the war in Afghanistan all the time. I mean, hundreds of reported incidents and probably thousands, because, you know, how many times do things like this, do these guys take shots at helicopters that you don't even know about? They almost all missed. I mean, it's just a fraction of a percent that actually hit. There's only a handful of helicopters that ever got hit by RPGs throughout the entire span of the war. And this is one of them. And it happened to be carrying a lot of people. And they got lucky. The only way this could have been prevented would have been through some sort of technical intelligence mechanism that this doesn't exist. Maybe in the future, they'll be able to scan an entire area so efficiently, so quickly, and so thoroughly that they'd be able to identify, you know, not only confirmed enemy forces, but potential enemy forces like these guys would have been. They just happen to be there. So, but that mechanism doesn't exist other than in concept.
Well, and I imagine the problem is, because you talk a little bit in the book about when some of these forces scattered on the original raid, then they get into an area of population and there's concern mm-hmm. about collateral damage, so they don't fire. And I imagine as a chopper is coming in and maybe through their infrared, they might be able to see human elements on the ground, but they're not allowed to just start firing unless they know that they're in danger, right?
Yeah, that's the case, but that wasn't the case here. Nobody saw these guys. Nobody knew about it. It wasn't even an opportunity, because there were two Apaches that were flying, circling the landing zone that they were headed toward, and they had their scanners focused on the landing zone and the area directly around it, because that's where you want to look for enemy, because that's when the helicopter is at its most vulnerable, where it's lowest and slowest, both coming into land and then relaunching. So that's where all their scans were. They just happened to fly by this village. And, you know, it's a numbers game, because think about all the helicopter flights in Afghanistan. I don't know, probably over a million. I don't even know what the number is. And all the times that they were shot at, and just I can only count five helicopters that were ever shot down in the entire span of the war by RPGs. It's such a remarkably low number compared to all the successes. But, you know, because sure. It was such a tragedy,
yeah.
We really focus on it.
Yeah, anytime you lose service members, and, you know, that's something that they want to focus on and try to make sure that doesn't happen again. And I imagine that it's just an inherent danger of the helicopter, because to carry that many people, you need something big, and it's going to be somewhat slow because it's got to be able to land, and that's just something you can only do so much about, I would suppose.
Exactly. The Chinook is the fastest helicopter in the Department of Defense operationally, but like you said, it was coming in to land. It was less than a minute from landing, and it was flying relatively slow, and it was low. And that's just the risk of war, not just with helicopters, with anything. Sometimes they get lucky. They get it right. They can exploit. Just they didn't exploit anything with this, other than just happen to be there. But that's just the nature of war, and that's the one element that will never change. It's getting less and less due to technology, and like we discussed earlier, the integration of all these different force types in operations, particularly, you know, intelligence capabilities. But it's just chance is still part of the battlefield. So even in modern war.
Yeah, and I imagine it always will be. The Final Mission of Extortion 1-7, Ed Derrick is the author. The book's available now in hardback, in bookstores, and online. Is there will this become a movie eventually, Ed? I would imagine that you've talked to somebody about that already at this point.
Yeah, some people express interest. I don't know if it'll be a movie. I hope that not just to enrich myself, but I hope every American reads this book. And I thank you very much for having me on to talk about it. It's a story of stories. It's a horrible tragedy, but it really opens a window for folks like us who are not war fighters to be able to understand modern warfare, modern American military. And I think it would be great if it would become a movie. I don't know. I'm not in control of that.
Sure,
we'll see.
Sure.
I mean, it's only been out for, I think, not even 2 months now.
Yeah.
2 months tomorrow.
Yeah.
So.
Well, not just the modern American warfare machinery-wise, but also the human element, because you do a great job of getting into that. And I appreciate that, because I think we need to hear more of the stories of the individual soldiers, because we don't I think America does a better job of respecting and protecting their soldiers than we probably have in many years. But I think we still take for granted what everybody really goes through in these battles that we put them into every day over in these places like Afghanistan. Ed Derrick, The Final Mission of Extortion 1-7. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. This has been wonderful. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Have a great one.
You too, Ed. I hope we chat again.